This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Our first crime. We meet some very old friends from Choker's private investigation agency in Fiona Hardy's latest work, Old Game. So, Fiona, welcome back to 3CR.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, it's an odd partnership here between Alice and Teddy, the latter having a slightly ambiguous name. They even end up in bed together in this book, and they're leading double lives. Reacquaint us with Alice and Teddy and their lives they're leading.
So the first book I wrote about Alice and Teddy was Unbury the Dead, which came out in March last year. And also, yes, so that had Alice and Teddy in it as well. And they are very hard to describe. Actually, every time I go to describe them, I can't do it in less than about 50 sentences or I waffle on a bit because they're detectives, they're private detectives, but they're also maybe criminals. They're essentially criminals. I think I equivocate a bit when I say it, but I should just say they're criminals, they're private detectives. Sometimes they're doing illegal work, so this book, for example, starts with them with a body in the trunk that they're trying. They don't really know exactly why, but they have to send a message to this particular person.
And they're using physical coercion. But Alice's back life, other life?
Yeah, but she is. They're also there in their late 20s. They're living very normal lives. And on the other hand, because Alice is a young mother, she's got Cherry, who's about 4 years old. She's got a loving partner. She's got this very stable life at home where everything's going really well. But then she goes to work. Look, a lot of the time they are doing very straight jobs as well. Like, they're not terrible people. And usually when they're doing bad things, it's to other people who are also terrible people.
Terrible people. Teddy, sort of dubious behaviour.
She is kind of the one who will always get up to the most mischief at any given time and interact poorly with the witnesses and doesn't, you know.
Well, when you say poorly, what exactly do you mean?
Well, you know, if you're reading a typical kind of crime book that's maybe a police procedural, they would not interfere with witnesses by, you know, making out with them. But she would not really have those types of qualms. So her style.
So there's some question about the nature of these two investigators. But now we have the disappearance of a body. But it's a different sort of disappearance. You've got the old trope of a body needed to be investigated. But hang on, what's the difference and how are you playing with the trope here?
As somebody who's read a lot of crime books and just loves all of them, so many different types of genres, I was trying to mix things up a little bit with this one particularly. And so instead of having a typical kind of dead body that's missing, that's, you know, maybe been dug out of a grave or they've just freshly died, this is actually somebody who's been dead for 7 years now. And their ashes are in an urn on a very loved mantelpiece, always looked at, always talked to, but now they're gone.
So basically, we've got a body that isn't a body, but ashes, and it raises all sorts of questions. Who are the ashes of?
So Ashley Perry Perrineau is a Australian Open tennis player, ridiculously famous, very successful, probably in about the early 2000s. He was in his 40s when he passed away, mysteriously, on the Mornington Peninsula, and his ashes have been on his widower, Sunny Prasad's shelf since then. And Sunny has gone on to live continue to live his life, basically, but always with the knowledge that he wanted to carry on Perry's legacy, keep his name famous and make sure that people kind of respect his partner and things like that.
But just to clarify then about the nature of Perry's life, would you like to detail that in a bit, flesh it out a bit more?
Yes. So Perry was a gay tennis player when even now that is not something as, you know, in sports. It's really something that still with male sports people especially is still very hidden. It might be something that only comes out after retirement or just never does at all. People might spread rumours and things like that. It's all very unhealthy. But whereas in women's sports, it's not something that's, you know, pushed under any rugs or anything like that. It's okay. So it's it was something that was kind of fun to talk about in a book where it was just this is who he was. On the whole, the Australian, I think somebody mentions in the book where they're like, we actually value, a journalist who's like, yeah, sure, most of the people would, you know, might be pretty bigoted about things like that. But unfortunately, Australians just love sports too much, so we can overlook these things sometimes.
Well, yes, because they're a sporting star, drug addiction or infidelity or anything like that, that's fine. They're a great sporting hero and an icon, and they're going to be put made into a statue and put near the MCG somewhere. But now this leads to this whole question of obsessiveness and the nature of the people that follow those sports stars or who are emotionally attached to these sports stars or who think they're emotionally attached to these sports stars. And you've really got incredibly obsessive behaviour. And we need to tease out some of these characters. Sunit, mm-hmm. Who's he?
So Sunit is the partner, terrible that I've written this book and I can't remember if they got married or not, of Perry. And they were together in a very loving relationship. And for him, he is very determined to make sure that people still remember Perry and that he has things like a statue.
But this creates problems for Lewis. Who's Lewis?
Oh, Lewis is Sonny's new partner. They also have a very healthy relationship. Lewis is very respectful of the fact that Perry is a big part of everybody's life still. He doesn't want to be dismissive of that. But for him, he's not, I guess, confident in replacing somebody of the stature of, a hugely successful and wealthy sports celebrity in Australia.
this notion of male insecurity comes out. And we also have another insecure male, Kirk. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Kirk is their accountant and not a very well-liked man by people on the whole, but he was very good friends with Perry when he was alive and really enjoyed the kind of lifestyle that, being friends with a celebrity can come with. Which is something I'm sure we'd all like to experience as well, but for now we can just imagine it and write about it.
But, yeah, that jealousy, and it's just a friendship there between those two, but it's gone now, so we need some way of replacing it. May Harper. Tell me about May.
May was one of my favourite characters I think that I've ever written because I think I just created somebody and I was like, what could be the most scandalous or terrible thing that somebody could say right now or devious, I guess. She's not really terrible in that sense, but there's one of my most entertaining scenes with her is when she wants to have a conversation with Alice and Teddy, and Alice is particularly adept at driving, so she often chauffeurs people around. And so May calls her up and says, could you please drive me to my hairdresser? And so they pick her up and they drive around. She says, left here, right here. And May lives in the city and they keep driving. And then eventually Alice is like, I feel like we're going back to the city. And she's like, it's fine, don't worry about it. And gossiping about all the things that she wants to talk about because May loves the sound of her own voice. And then eventually they end up right back in front of her apartment again where she says, did I not mention that my hairdresser comes to me? Thank you, goodbye. And then just walks out of the car again. So I enjoyed having somebody like that in the book.
But there's some question about May's behaviour when she was a tennis player.
Yes, she did. She was a very questionable person all along. When she was a famous tennis player, as Perry's doubles partner, she, even back then, she was doing everything she could. She leaned into the kind of more scandalous aspect of being a celebrity and thought that people would enjoy that part of her.
But there's also this notion of gambling and losing games for money.
Yes, exactly. So she's very unscrupulous and doesn't really mind.
Now, every sporting hero needs a statue, but we've got Aviva making statues of Perry. But there's something rather macabre about the way Aviva goes about it.
So yes, Aviva, oh my goodness, can't pronounce my own character's name. Aviva loves to create things and she loves to hire people who do a lot of the creation for her. She has her whole business where she kind of gets interns in and makes them do a lot of the work for her. And one of the things she likes to do is imbibe all of the things that she creates with something to do with the actual creation itself. Like she's sculpting a bunny, then perhaps she would use some rabbit fur inside it. So if she's actually sculpting a giant statue of a man, what would she maybe put in that? Who knows?
The ashes?
Maybe. Oh, man.
Maybe. So all of these characters have a motivation or reason, perhaps. And, I mean, the way you've described it here, there's another one we'll get back to, another character. Leonie is a ghoul. That's a ghoul. That's good enough reason for me. May might be trying to hide what's written on the note in the ashes, though I'm not sure, since she's the one who told us about it. Kirk is jealous. Aviva wanted the ashes for creative purity. Perry's mother wants them to complete her hobby of hoarding dead relatives. Lewis is jealous, and Ludo might lose his job and needs the money. So you've summed up all the characters there.
I think I had to do that to remind myself of who everybody was.
but they're false and pretentious. I mean, Audrey basically hires a dog. What's going on there? Perry's mother.
Yeah, so Audrey is Perry's mother and she also wants to kind of sustain Perry's reputation, but for her it's more of a malicious she wants to be involved. She wants people to be looking at her and thinking how wonderful she is. And so she will make up anything that she can to kind of get people to think that she is the wonderful person behind everything, when she is in fact doing her best to manipulate others and sideline Sunny and not really respect what Perry was like at all as a person. Because he's, of course, passed away for the whole book, but he seems like a nice guy, I think.
So, you know, all of these range of motivations. Now, we're going to get to one character for the sake of our other guest author today. You've got an investigative journalist in your story. What's going on there?
I do. I'm feeling the pressure answering this question, I have to say now. So my investigative journalist, again, another word that I can't say suddenly, despite putting it in my book, he is definitely another person. So he's not working for the type of newspaper or journalism that I would be reading. He's the kind of person who is he's looking for the people who would be bigoted against somebody like Perry. He would usually be supporting that kind of angle. And he is chasing Teddy and Alice and wondering what it is that they're looking for, because at the moment Perry's ashes and the loss of them is not publicised. And so they're trying to keep it quiet. And so he's going, but he knows Teddy and Alice from Unbury the Dead when things went quite wrong for him. And so he is after them going, why are you here? Why are you being so involved in this? And yes.
But what tactics does he employ?
So he is quite manipulative. He will do anything and even insert himself into their very personal lives and threaten them and the people that they love with being unveiled.
But this is the case with all the characters. They're all being unscrupulous in their own way and manipulative for their own benefit. Even Alice and Teddy.
Yes, it is. It's true. They are very flawed characters. I have to say there's almost nobody who's a good person in the entire book. Maybe Alice's four-year-old child is a good... She's a good girl.
But here you go. You've got a detective agency, by the way, with its own HR department.
Yes, that's basically run by a criminal who will say, you know, let's send people out to... You might have to go rough somebody up to get a message across. But we do have a physio on hand. So if you're feeling some kind of repetitive strain injury from all the torture you've been doing, perhaps we can look into that for you and help, help support you.
And a bit of psychological therapy.
Yeah, they do. They have psychologists on staff as well. Of course,
if you're going to rough somebody up, you need some therapy afterwards. You go into some other interest. Well, you know, you've raised the question of ethics there. You've raised the question of homosexuality in sport. The other things, here's an interesting one, which I put to Jan just a moment ago, and she was puzzled. Can you actually insure human remains?
You know, I should have looked further into this. I kind of used it in the book as a fictional part of the story and landed on not really, to just kind of move the story along itself. And because the idea of having not just kind of human remains, but ones that might be worth something on the black market because Perry was a celebrity, what does that mean? You know, it's it was something that I was like a different type of crime that I was trying to go into.
A different type of crime, because it's an ashes being stolen, not a body. There's actually a note in the urn as well, which activates all of these characters to take things further. But if the listener wants to find out more, they're actually going to have to pick up a copy of Old Games. The author is Fiona Hardy, and it's from Affirm Press.
Yes.
Fiona, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, David.
Well, we were talking about an investigative journalist, and Louise Milligan brought us the facts about a gynecologist operating unnecessarily on young women for his personal monetary gain. An earlier piece of investigative journalism was about the Catholic Church in Ireland, and this research led to her new book, Shelley Banks. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jan.
When an Australian thinks beach, Shelley Banks is certainly not what we imagine. But your mother, all her 10 siblings, and even you played there. So what's Shelley Banks like?
So Shelley Banks is a beach near Ringsend, which is where my mum and her siblings grew up. Ringsend is a sort of village within a city of Dublin where everyone knows each other and was very working class. Shelley Banks is this small grey water, grey sand, cockle shells. And Dublin Bay is a big U-shaped bay and the tide goes out for kilometres and then it comes whooshing back in. And, you know, back in the day when my mum and her siblings were growing up and my nana as well, people didn't learn how to swim. Like, mum's just learning how to swim now in her 70s. And they would get caught and drown.
Well, you've got a fiction character in your book, Kate Delaney, and her early memory of wearing patent leather shoes and white frilly anklet socks with her nana and favourite auntie Dolores watching. And that happened to Kate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a recurring dream as when I was a child about being caught in the undertow of Shelley Banks and running for the limestone wall. And it was always this metaphor for trauma, running away from it in a way for me. I suppose I didn't really think about it in those terms when I was younger, but I always thought that it would be such a good theme for a book.
Well, to this day, Kate is still fragile in water, but she has other things to trigger. She's got a serious case of PTSD. And this all came from your previous book, Pheasant's Nest. Now, it was a whole book, but you wrapped it up beautifully in about six lines in this book, and it's a hard read. So let's hear.
Anally raped in a dark alleyway, kidnapped by the loser who did it, locked in a freezing cage under a highway bridge, with only the ghosts of suicides to keep her company, left to contemplate her death while he threw himself to his. She just tried to survive, and almost didn't, until they found her.
Oh, look, that's very...
It's a lot, Jan.
It is
poor
a lot.
Poor old Kate is
traumatised.
She's very traumatised, yeah.
She usually carried a cockle shell from Shelley Bank to bring her luck. She didn't have it on that night of her rape and kidnapping. But through that book, Pheasant's Nest, and this one, she's supported by her partner, Liam Carroll. Now, he is such a nice man.
He's gorgeous.
And let's hear what you've written about Liam Carroll from page 55.
His hands have the softness of a solicitor who spends his weekends thumbing through vintage vinyl at record shops and turning the pages of the latest issue of The New Yorker. He has never known exactly what to do with a spirit level and feels like he should win a Nobel Prize when he successfully constructs flat pack furniture.
I like that. Well, Kate and Liam are going back to Ireland for Kate's favourite aunt, her good-looking aunt, as she said, who still smokes and she calls
like a chimney.
Outside to have a word with Nico.
Yeah, she's kind of based on one of my aunties to some extent who does that. Every time she sees me when she greets me at the airport or at her house, she's like, oh, fucking come here to me.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
And swearing with an Irish accent always sounds good. So they're coming back into Dublin for Dolores's celebration, but it turns into something much sadder.
She's due to marry for the first time in her life. She's in her mid to late 50s and her husband-to-be suddenly takes ill and dies.
And there's the funeral and the open casket. It just sort of seems so different. And then there's the removal. Can you explain what a removal is?
So a removal is a viewing of the body, and that happens in most houses or funeral parlours in Ireland when someone dies. And it's quite the event, and people line up down the street. And I actually went there when I went on one of my research trips for Shelley Banks. I went to the removal of a fiance of an auntie in advanced age. And so that scene is like very, very similar to what happened. And I think it's really interesting, like the Irish are much more at one with death. Like my late nana, you know, she loved nothing more than talking about death, but it means you are sort of confronted with the reality, and I think it actually assists in a way. But when you are an Australian who's not used to this, it's kind of hard to see when you're sort of in a tiny room, as I was and Kate is in this scene, this tiny little parlour with the heating on and the double glazing and a corpse in front of you that has makeup on, and the funeral parlour lady has warned everyone if the heating gets too high to turn it down because his makeup might run.
It's a horrible scene. And Dolores is an emotional mess. So they decide to go back to Shelley Banks. It was a happy place that she had with Kevin before he died. But what happens to Dolores and Liam at Shelley Banks?
Well, they almost drown in a pea soup fog. And that becomes a catalyst for Dolores. You know, she has been re-traumatised by Kevin's death. No one really knows why. There's always this, like, dark, gaping secret at the centre of Dolores. And Irish culture is full of secrets and lies because of generations of women being oppressed essentially by church and state things like the Magdalen laundries, the babies being buried at Tomb, etc. And Dolores has her own secrets, and that all becomes revealed when she's washed up on the sands at Shelleybanks and she tells Kate about her terrible past.
And that's what we have in part two of the book. And this is also Liam looks at his own life and decides to go back to Melbourne, which is fair enough. He's got an interesting case to work on back there. So part two of the book is about Dolores. Prior to turning 15, what was she like?
Dolores was, like my mum, one of 11 children, living in a two-bedroom house in Ringsend with a mother who was pregnant for 20 years, a father who was pretty useless.
A poor excuse of a father.
Yeah, and he's fictional, but he's got a lot of resonance in reality. And Dolores is just one of the in-betweeners who she has to leave school at 14 because her mammy can't afford to not have her leave school and bring in a wage. And that same thing happened to my mum and her sisters. And she's a bright, fizzy, mouthy, fantastic teenager who has so much spirit and loves David Bowie. And she dreams of a better future. She goes across to the library every day to try and expand her horizons and her vocabulary. But her mum sees an ad
that causes her life to become undone.
Yes. So it's an ad by a group. They're only known in the book as the group, but they're on the fringes of the Catholic Church. But they advertise cookery classes for young ladies. And her mum thinks that this might be a good opportunity, that it could lead to a job and also could teach Dolores how to cook so that she can get a husband and repeat the trajectory of her own life. And Dolores just wants to escape, so she goes, and it turns out to be something quite different.
So there's the directoress, Miss Nuala, with her doctorate in theology, and Miss Rosine?
Roisin.
Roisin. Oh, these Irish
names. They're unpronounceable. It's okay.
An accountant. Now, she goes and there's a laundry run by nuns, and the young women there are called help. You know, of course, I'm thinking unmarried mothers. But no, this is help.
Yeah, no.
Who do they help?
Yeah, so they're not nuns. They're actually, it is based on reality because I did sort of hear about this happening in my investigative journalism. But they're a group within the Catholic Church who have people who are celibate who live in these houses. And it's a bit like upstairs, downstairs. And at the bottom of the rung are the help. And these are women who are expected to be celibate, to work for no pay all hours of the day, to have no keys to the house, no money. They wear hand-me-down clothes and they eat leftover foods. And it sounds really extreme, but this actually happened. And I met a woman in Ireland called Anne-Marie Allen that this happened to. And I asked her if she would mind if I sort of, you know, took parts of her story to fictionalise. And Dolores finds herself becoming one of the help. And Miss Nuala and Miss Roisin are the sort of supervisors of the help. They're educated, but they're also expected to be celibate as well. And they're quite subtly and slyly abusive. And to the point where the girls are expected to help self-harm for the Lord.
For the Lord. When you write about this, you can see how Dolores is brought into it and why she accepts.
Groomed.
She's absolutely groomed. And she wants to prove that she can do something so that she can show her parents that she can do it. And she works very hard. And for this, and she gets the occasional love bombing, which she really reacts to.
So creepy.
Oh, and then there's the promise of Rome. And they find, you know, the things that she wants to do in Rome, they don't do, but they do have to pray before a saint. And maybe we can hear a little bit more from
page 100.
So
that's Saint Maria Goretti. Can you tell me about Saint Maria Goretti, Dolores asked Miss Nuala as they walked back to the apartment, hoping this might get her back in Miss Nuala's good books. Oh, she was wonderful, Miss Nuala said softly, a virgin martyr. Maria chose not to be violated. She was only 11 and a horrible man tried to rape her. Maria told him it was a sin and she would rather die than give up her purity to a man. Our purity is so precious, Dolores. It should be guarded at all times. And so he stabbed her 14 times, but she died pure. Maria is the patron saint of rape victims. Dolores looked at Miss Nuala. I don't understand, she said. How could it have been her fault if she was raped? Why is it a good thing that she died? Dolores had always got into trouble with the nuns at school for asking these sorts of impertinent questions. Imagine being stained like that, Dolores, and the shame it would have brought her, Miss Nuala said. What a brave thing to do. You should say a prayer to St. Maria Goretti every night. Miss Nuala's explanation made Dolores feel distinctly uncomfortable, but she didn't question her further.
If you enjoy that reading, you're going to love this book. Look, there's so much more to it. Dolores becomes pregnant, and what happens to that baby leads to Kate using her journalistic and computer skills of Facebook stalking to help the Garda find her. Garda?
The Garda, or the Gardaí for the plural, are the Irish police. I had never met any Gardaí before. I went on my research trips to Ireland and I met up with a retired inspector from the Aran Islands named Christie, and he gave me permission to use his name and some of his background. He was an absolutely lovely man, and the police in this book are very kind.
They are. There are dangerous currents of untold secrets, a vicious group in the Irish Catholic Church, and Facing Trauma in Shelley Banks, another crime novel by Louise Milligan. Just a fantastic read. Thank you so much for your writing and your investigative journalism.
Thanks so much, Jan. I really appreciate the opportunity.
A day of investigative cases. I had been talking with Fiona Hardy, Old Games, and that takes us out for another week.
And, of course, Louise Milligan with me, Shelley Banks.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.